like to offer some reflections. And the topic I'd like to invite your consideration today is one of the factors of the Eightfold Path. And I'm not going to tell you which one yet. Kind of it's part of the suspense of the talk. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the just a little bit about the Eightfold Path, and then I'll share with you, then you can guess. So, but one thing I'm going to tell you, and you can guess maybe in your mind so that you're engaged with this talk, the factor I want to talk about is one that even if you don't meditate, even if you don't have the time, as lay people, life can get pretty busy sometimes, right? That even if you don't have the time to sit and meditate in a day, but you're still practicing this path factor. You're still practicing this path factor internally and externally. So it's a really, really important one. And we keep making karma, either wholesome karma or unwholesome karma, toward through practicing this path factor. Okay, so let's remember what the path factors are for a moment. There are eight of them. It's the Eightfold Path. Okay, so it's the path factors. The first one is wise view. View the perspective that we have. It's just this container of either unwholesomeness, wholesomeness. So wise view is the first path factor. And then wise intention. Wise intention, our intention. And earlier today, I asked you about your intentions, connecting with your intention. Then after these two that set the stage, our view, our perspective, wise view, our perspective about life, our perspective about everything, perspective, wise view, and our intention of how we want to engage. After these two, then the third path factor is wise speech. And then the next three path factors are really life path factors. There is wise speech, there is wise action, there is wise livelihood, which again for us lay people is particularly important. So after these three that are really the worldly speech and conduct and livelihood, these factors, then there is wise effort. I prefer another E word instead of effort, which can feel like really effortful. I like engagement, wise engagement. How do we engage? How do we engage with our practice? How do we engage with life? How do we engage? And then there is wise mindfulness. We're all probably familiar. Well, we're all familiar. You're here. So you have practice with practicing mindfulness, awareness, stability of mind, wise mindfulness, the wise way to engage with that and do that. And last is wise samadhi, wise concentration, often translated as concentration. I don't love that translation, but really the wise way of stabilizing the mind, settling the mind, creating stability for our heart and mind to not be scattered everywhere, but just to be stable, to have a sense of connection. So all of these factors, they all interweave, and really you can't practice one without practicing the rest. They're all intertwined with one another. And all of them are very important for us to really spend time, maybe take each factor a month and give our heart to exploring it. And there are various programs also to do this. But today, what I wanted to talk about is, any guesses? Yeah, I can have an internal guess. Like, okay, I'm going to talk about why speech. I would like to talk about why speech. Because, hey, even if we don't get to sit and practice meditation, we're still either engaging with others in speech or internally. We're constantly, have you noticed this constant conversation we have about ourselves, about others? Like, it just keeps like, yeah, there's a speech happening all the time internally and also externally. So I'd like to offer some reflections about that. So first I want to say a few things about the word So in the Eightfold Path, as it laid out, all of these, the word wise or right, you might have heard right speech or wise speech. So the word actually is samma, S-A-M-M-A in Pali, samma, and samma vacha, vacha is speech. And samma vacha, the word samma, you know, at first, I remember when I heard right speech early on in my practice, it almost sounded to me puritanical, like right or wrong. This is right speech. That's wrong speech. Like, oh, okay. So there was a little bit of tightness. And then I liked why speech more as a choice of word. And of course, we know that choice of words are so important, especially speaking of why speech. So, and then more recently, actually, I start to look more into the word samma. And samma, really what it means is appropriate. What is appropriate, as in the use of appropriate tool? So, you know, if you're cooking, you want a ladle, you don't want a hammer. It's like the appropriate tool. What's appropriate speech? What's the right tool? What's the right speech? So the right in that way, not right and wrong, but the right, appropriate thing to say, not the inappropriate thing. So right in that way. So now I'm more relaxed about using right speech with that understanding of appropriate speech. So I share that with you. Something that I've discovered. So I'll use those words interchangeably today. Right speech, wise speech, appropriate speech. So speech is powerful, very, very powerful. Our words shape our minds, either paving the path towards freedom or cementing habitual patterns of suffering. There's this quote that I found outside the Buddhist canon, and this is from the book Atomic Habits by James Clear. It's a great book if you're trying to start any new habits and leave unhelpful ones. A great book, Atomic Habits. And this is the way he puts it. I like that. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become. No single instance will transform your beliefs, but as the votes build up, so does the evidence of your new identity. So that is true for our speech. Our speech, not the single thing we say, but as we continue to speak, it's a vote for the person we wish to become, we wish to be. And it's so important to lift a mirror to ourselves and ask, does my speech represent who I think I am or the person I aspire to be? Does my speech really represent that or not? Or do I think I'm this kind, good, loving person and I'm very mindful and I'm like, oh, wow, look at my speech. So I'll say this at the beginning. I'm going to say this at the end after I've shared the guidelines or the various guidelines that the Buddha gives for this. So speech, as we already know, it has you know, sitting, of course, it has consequences, practice sitting silently, but we also know that speech has consequences that are amplified throughout the world. Either we can provide succor for others, support, we can spread harmony and goodwill, or we can cause harm and perpetuate discord and ill will. So it's very strong, it's very impactful. Especially in these days with social media, with the tremendous speed and the reach of social media, our words, that we can just like, you know, we have a reaction, we just write something and off it goes, like, okay, oof. We fashion our world that way and we fashion our karma. We fashion the tendencies for the future, for karma as a way of the tendencies that we'll have both in the future and also the impact with how we act. We are the beneficiaries. We are the owners of our actions, our wholesome as well as unwholesome actions. Whatever we do, of those we shall become the heir. Whatever we do in the world, we are the heir to our actions. We're born of our actions. We are related to our actions. Karma is such a beautiful teaching. It's not so much about, what did I do in some previous life that I don't even know. No, let's not go there. That's not really helpful. Let's stay with this life. Karma right here and right now. What I do today, the kind words or the unkind words that I perpetuate through the world, they impact both how I'm going to act, what I'm going to say in the future. For example, if I lie, I'm going to get myself into a bind to lie more and more and more. It's going to get more complicated. I have to remember what I said, and like, oh gosh, this story is going to be complicated. Does that person know it? Like, whoa, there it is. Karma. You're creating your karma through what you say, as well as impacting others. It's just that. Let's relate to karma in that way. And also, as I mentioned earlier, this does include the words that we say to ourselves, because sometimes we talk with such unkindness to ourselves that we would never, ever use with others, the tone. And gosh, is that wild? A wise speech? Am I speaking with the mind of goodwill, as you see, is one of the questions that the Buddha asks us to ask ourselves. So in the guidelines that I'm going to share, the Buddha both taught us what to avoid and what to cultivate. So you'll see both of those. It's don't do this. Do this. So the basket of teachings has both of those. Very, very beautiful. So right speech is defined as abstaining from lying, divisive speech, abusive speech, and idle chatter. And I'll talk about these a lot more in a moment, but just setting it up. So lying, divisive speech, abusive speech, idle chatter. Don't do that, the Buddha says. And then he gives five guidelines, and then the right speech abstaining, what I mentioned, there are various places in the suttas where this is defined, and those of you who appreciate sutta references is from Samyutta Nikaya 45.8. That's where the reference is. And then the Buddha gives five guidelines for well-spoken speech. And these five, they have some relationship and overlap with the things not to do, but some of them are an expansion. So here we go. So is it timely? Is it true? Is it gentle? Is it beneficial? And is it spoken with a mind of goodwill? Again, I'll repeat them. Is it timely? Is it true? Is it gentle? Is it beneficial? And beneficial here specifically means, is it connected to the goal of the path? That's how benefit is defined. And is it spoken with a mind of goodwill? And this is from AN 5.198, it's a reference. And then there's another teaching which is so beautiful. Maybe if there's time, I'll talk at length about that, but at least I'll mention it. In Majjhima Nikaya 58, the Buddha gives additional instructions for how to speak when something you want to say is disagreeable to others. It's, people don't want to hear it. How do you do it? So beyond being factual, true, and beneficial, you have to wait for the right time. So I'll talk more about that. It's really beautiful teaching. So let's step back now. In a moment, I'll talk more about these guidelines and unpack each of them. But first, as we approach this whole area of why speech, there are two things to do, two ways to practice wise speech. So listen up. So the first step is to make an intentional commitment to these guidelines, both for the impact they have on us, knowing that, yes, I am the person who's impacted first and foremost by what I say. This is a formal practice. And for the sake of others, for the sake of impact I have on others. So first, it's an intentional commitment. So it ties in with wise intention, the previous path factor. So first we make an intention. Okay, I'm not going to lie, or I'm not going to engage in divisive speech. I'm just not going to do that. Just making a commitment and taking it as a training. So then the second step of the practice, of overall practice, is with these guidelines, is as a formal training in real time, as you are speaking, take a breath, rest in the body, rest in the body. Feel the body, become embodied, and become aware of your intention and state of mind and the body in real time. So for example, if you find that you're about to shade the truth, am I stressed right now? Am I motivated by greed? Am I motivated by desire for recognition, for self-aggrandizement, or am I afraid I'll be rejected or judged? What's going on right now? What's going on right now, sweetie? What's happening? Okay, why do you want to lie? So really becoming aware of our intention, state of the mind, state of the body in real time, as a way to study ourselves, as a way to hold up a mirror, as a way to understand ourselves. Oh yeah, this kind of situation really makes me anxious. Okay, what's going on? Okay, I see that. And then can I now reconnect now that I've taken a pause, now that I've regrounded with my body and reconnected with my bigger intention, my intention for cultivating wholesomeness, goodness, for liberation, for freedom, not causing harm to myself, not causing harm to others. Do I still want to lie? Do I still want to shade the truth a little bit? Do I still want to? No, it's not worth it, really. It's just not. So can we shift? It's possible to shift the energy, if there's unwholesomeness, towards wholesomeness, towards wise engagement, wise effort, wise engagement in real time. Again, all these path factors coming in, right? Mindfulness, we're becoming mindful of our body, our intention, of our speech. So these are the ways to practice with wise speech. Again, connecting with setting a bit intention ahead of time. And then in real time, noticing, why am I saying this? Why am I talking, it's wanting to talk behind that other person's back? Like, why? Am I trying to like win favor for myself, to make myself seem, you know, more important, better than them, so that this person I'm talking to, like, they won't like them, they'll be my friend more? Like, oh, sweetheart, do you really want to do this? Is this worth your karma? I mean, do you really want to do this? So in real time, becoming aware of these movements and reconnecting with our goodness, and also knowing that this is a practice, this is a cultivation day by day. And if we fail, it's like, okay, yeah, I did. Yeah, shade the truth a little bit there. It's okay, sweetheart. I see that. I see you. And I have remorse. And I forgive you and I move on and I vow to do better. Instead of self-flagellating forever, like, oh, you're no good, you're terrible, you can't say, ouch. That's not cultivating compassion either. So now I want to say a little bit about these guidelines that I laid out, both as I gave out to you the definition of what is right speech and how to, the guidelines. So the four guidelines and the five guidelines, actually, if you kind of combine them, there's some overlaps, they become six guidelines. So I have six guidelines to share with you. And I'll ask Emiko to put those in the document so that you'll have them. So the first one is, which is the most important one, is it true and factual? Is it true and factual? Okay. So let's talk about, is it true first? And I'll get to factual, which is an important nuance, but I'll bring that later. So is it true? This really first guideline, really first guideline, the commitment to truthfulness is the most important one. It is so important that I was touched when I learned this. It's so important that through the lifetimes of a bodhisattva, so a bodhisattva going through many, many, many lifetimes, serving others and becoming a Buddha through many, many, many lifetimes, a bodhisattva can break all the other moral precepts. They can be broken through their training to become a Buddha, except for one, and that is the commitment to truthfulness. Wow. That's profound, right? So that's one moral precept that is unbreakable, that's just unbreakable for a bodhisattva through many, many, many lifetimes of their training. So important is our commitment for the truth. And it makes sense, right? Because because truthfulness, really, our commitment to it is a reflection of liberation itself, because liberation is this the recognition of what is truthfulness of things as they are. It's just this open-heartedness. So lying, shading the truth, or being deceitful, it just completely goes against that. So so is it true? Is it true? Now the Buddha says so the Buddha instructs us not to tell a lie for one's own sake, or for the sake of another, or for the sake of any reward. But this sake of another is also an important one. I found this in the suttas, and it also goes along a research study that there was this research study that I'll talk more about later, that actually they found that if people lying for oneself, they encouraged, I'll tell you what, I'll just wait until I get to this study, because I feel like I'll keep you on the edge of your seat. Tell you what, I'll talk about this study in a few minutes. So just a couple minutes, but a couple of other things I wanted to say. Falsehoods, as you well know, erode trust, and trust is the pillar of any relationship. And again, there's relationship research showing that when there is no trust in the relationship doesn't quite gel or falls apart. Trust really is the pillar of every relationship. And Friedrich Nietzsche puts it very well. He says, "I'm not upset that you lied to me. I'm upset that from now on, I can't believe you." And if you've had anyone who's ever lied to you, ouch, there is such a big ouch. You can forgive that they lied to you, but the fact that, oh, you can't trust them anymore, it's such a pain, it's so difficult. And this abstaining from lying and how it actually makes us distrustful is in fables, is in the Boy Who Cried Wolf story. And I remember as a little kid growing up in Iran, I was thinking about this last night. I think it was in our third grade, fourth grade book, grade school, after we could start to read any, you know, like, here's the story, like, oh, see what happened to this boy who cried wolf. Nobody believed them anymore. So this sense of these And I haven't asked any friends to know when that might have showed up in the U.S. In the books here. But I am curious. Maybe later somebody will raise their hand and you'll tell me. But yeah, it was definitely in the grade school books when I raised when in Iran when I grew up. Mark Twain says, "Lying. If you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything." And that's another aspect of truthfulness, that it just simplifies your life, right? You don't have to remember what you said. Like, oh yeah, when you tell a lie, it just gets things more and more complicated. And the Buddha teaching Rahula, his son, that again, there's a beautiful sutta where the Buddha points to a bowl of water. There's a tiny bit of water in the bowl. And the Buddha says, "Rahula, do you see this bit of water in the bowl? So little, Rahula, is the spiritual achievement of one who is not afraid to speak a deliberate lie." And then the Buddha throws the water out and puts the bowl down and say, "Do you see, Rahula, how that water has been discarded? In the same way, one who tells a deliberate lie discards whatever spiritual achievement one has made." Wow. And then it goes on. And then, "Do you see how this bowl is now empty? In the same way that one has no shame in speaking lies is empty of spiritual achievement." And then the Buddha turns the bowl upside down and says, "Do you see, Rahula, how this bowl has been turned upside down? In the same way, one who tells a deliberate lie turns one's spiritual achievements upside down and becomes incapable of progress." Whew, that's strong words. Hence the connection with how important truthfulness is in the path towards awakening, full awakening. So now I can tell you about the study. So the Buddha also talks about the dangers in telling a deliberate lie in another sutta. So there's a danger in telling a deliberate lie, because there is the slippery slope of further unethical behavior. So there's a study in 2016 that was published in Nature Neuroscience in the lab of Tully, Charotte, and colleagues. So what they did is that they brought a bunch of subjects into their lab, and they set up this study to tempt people to lie. Of course, they got ethical approval from the board anyway for doing this, but this is just very cleverly done. So they had participants with 30, they showed the participants pictures of 30 glass jars, each containing, say, between 1,500 and 3,500 pennies. And the participants were asked to estimate how many pennies were in the jar. Okay, straightforward, right? You've probably done this kind of thing, right? Straightforward. But then the participants would send the advice via a computer to a partner whom they were told they would submit an estimate on behalf of both of them. So now they... And then they told the partner, here's what got interesting. So in one version of the experiment, they were told that they would be paid according how much their partner overestimated, while their partner would be paid according to how accurate their estimate was. So basically, as you would expect, the participants faced the temptation to do something unethical, to lie about how many pennies. Again, this is small, right? This is tiny. How many pennies they thought were in the jar, so that they would receive more money for themselves and less money for their partner. Okay. So at first, participants lied only a little. They inflated their estimates only by a few hundred pennies. And then as the course of the study, it went on and on, they start to lie more and more and more. Their estimates became higher and higher. And by the end of the study, their estimates were nearly twice as high as when they began. So slippery slope. But wait, there is more. This is what's amazing. So at the beginning of the study, their amygdala, which is the area that in the brain that tends to get activated with fear and kind of alarm, is basically the alarm area network of the brain. So when they lied, the amygdala would light up. So they would feel uncomfortable, discomfort about their lying. They would feel bad that they had lied. You guessed it, as the experiment kept going and going, their amygdala became less activated. Wow. So their body wasn't, they became less sensitive to their diet, to their lying. They were not as sensitive, and they would lie. They would estimate, oh yeah, twice as many coins. Oh yeah, I'm going to be like, and the amygdala was just silent. It wouldn't light up. It wouldn't raise a danger sign. So their body, their ethical tuning fork, which is our body, right? We feel bad, like, oh, when you say something unkind, I'm like, oh, that felt bad. That didn't feel really good. I'm like, yeah. Their body, this compass, this tuning fork became less sensitive to support them to live, to act ethically, to speak ethically. And that is profound. So that I just want to pause for a moment. You get how profound this is, right? Yeah. How our actions, habitual actions, either make our body, our physiology, our brain more sensitive or less sensitive to ethical or unethical behavior. Wow. So powerful, so powerful. So, before moving on, wow, time's flying. I need to speed up. This is such a rich topic, such a rich topic. As you can see, I'm loving sharing this with you. This is so exciting, such an exciting practice, really. But I'll speed up a little bit. So, but one thing I did want to add here before moving on to the other guidelines is factual. I mentioned true and factual. So here's what the Buddha says is the nuance here, that not only does something need to be true, but also it needs to be supported by the facts. It needs to be supported by, objectively supported, not just according to our feelings and perceptions, right? It's okay, but it could be true. It could be my truth, right? That's kind of common these days that we say it's my, according to my feelings, my sensations, like what you hurt me. It was terrible what you said, what you did. Well, according to my feelings and sensations, yes, that's not. And yet, like, oh yes, you said something that, well, because I was very sensitized, I was having a bad day. Like, oh yeah, that hurt me in this day, but you know, so it's really, it's not just true, but also factual. Is it supported by the facts of what actually happened? So both of those. So we really need to bring not just our perception, and very hard as a human being, right? Because our lens of perception is our lens of perception. But can we step back and say, okay, I have my lens of perception, but actually, can I be objective? Can I see really what happened, for example, between the two of us? Okay, what actually happened? They said this. Okay, yeah, I guess I can see. I mean, I don't really know what their intention was. Maybe their intention wasn't what I attributed it to be. Like, maybe they had a different intention, etc. So bringing more of what is objectively supported by actually what happened. And that reminds me actually of this great book that's called Difficult Conversations. And I don't remember the authors right now, excuse me. That really, to me, it's a Buddhist book because it talks about, you know, especially when we've had a difficult interaction and difficult conversations, we're planning one to really separate out of the impact and our intentions from what we perceive the impact, what we perceive the intention to have been, to what really perhaps the intention was, to really separate all of those out and also have three different conversations from our perceptions, the person, the other person's perceptions, and also conversation about facts. What really happened? This person said this statement, this person said that statement. Devoid of the feelings and interpretations. So it's in that book, it's called like a factual conversation. Like what happened? And that's, I feel like this is where the Buddha is pointing to. What's factual? What actually happened? What's, you know, what is factual? So, all right, I'm going to move on to the next one. So the next one is a very important one too. The question is it divisive or does it create harmony? So the Buddha here tells us, I'll read a piece of the sutta, beautiful. So abandoning divisive speech, one abstains from divisive speech. When one has heard here, one does not tell there to break those people apart from these people. What one has heard there, one does not tell here to break these people apart from those people. Wow. So this, again, as I was referring to earlier, how do we speak about divisive speech? And if we are, what is our intention? What is our intention? And slanderous and divisive speech is based on hatred, ill will. It's enmeshed often with resentment, envy, intention to hurt another, win respect for our support for ourselves. And guess what? It carries a doubly heavy karma because it's involving forethought. Not only does it have one heavy karma because of the root of hatred and ill will, but this is because we have thought about, you know, there's planning, like, oh yeah, I'm going to say something bad to tear them apart. It has doubly heavy karma. And then the Buddha tells us to, this is how, this is so beautiful, to reconcile those who have broken apart and cement those who are united. One loves concord, delights in concord, enjoys concord, speak things that create concord. How beautiful is that, to actually speak goodness about other people behind their back? Oh, you're friends with so-and-so. How wonderful. She, he, they, they're great. This is like, oh, yes. So really bring people together, instead of the opposite. Moving on to the next one, number three. Is it harsh and abusive or is it gentle? So harsh and abusive speech here is basically speech that is spoken in anger, with a hot temper perhaps, or with mean sarcasm, intended to rebuke and demean someone, insult someone, cause pain, and it has aversion as its root. And it's often impulsive. You know, we just say something that we perhaps immediately regret, you know, with such a sharp tone. We raise our voice. It's just very harsh, abusive. It has a lighter karmic weight than slander because it doesn't have forethought. The antidote to it is patience. And when speaking wisely is impossible, our secondary goal becomes to cause the least harm possible. And then the Buddha continues, again, the positive aspect of this is the Buddha directs us to speak words that are soothing to the ear, affectionate, go to the heart, polite, likable, and agreeable to the people. I just love it. The suttas are so beautiful. Words that are soothing to the ear, affectionate, go to the heart, polite, likable, and agreeable to the people. So beautiful. Okay. Next one. Is it idle chatter or is it beneficial? I've put these two together because they connect. Is it idle chatter? So for monastics, any talk that is not associated with Dharma and the goal of liberation is considered idle chatter. But of course, we lay people, we live according to a different standard. We do connect, we speak in order to build relationships, right? So we have small talk. So for us, it's a little different. However, we still, it's important for us to notice what we feed our mind. Engaging with the media, especially with social media and what we're consuming? Is it idle chatter? The word in Pali is an onomatopoeia, which is sampapalapa. Sampapalapa. I love that word. It's for idle chatter. Sampapalapa. Like, oh, what are you? This is just sampapalapa. I'm not going to engage with that. Sampapalapa. Say it a few times. It's fun. Sampapalapa. So sampapalapa. So why are we speaking? Say we're in a group or in with someone else. Are we rushing to fill an uncomfortable silence with some papalapa? Are we indulging in something that's kind of titillating and getting riled up with the sense of self and self-righteousness? Some papalapa. These kinds of engagements, they tend to dull our spiritual sensitivities. The same way that in the study I mentioned, our ethical sensitivity can be dulled. Similarly, our spiritual sensitivity can be dulled. Jonathan Faust, a teacher, has a great acronym. And the acronym is WAIT. Why am I talking? Why am I talking when you're talking? Why am I talking? Why am I talking? What? Again, here, this is so beautiful from the suttas. The Buddha instructs us to speak words that are, speak words worth treasuring. Speak words worth treasuring. Seasonable, reasonable, circumscribed, connected to the goal. All right. Okay. Two more. Covering the time remaining. All right. This one. The next one, the fifth one I have is, am I speaking with a mind of goodwill? So this is often, this instruction is often expressed in shorthand as, is it kind? Yes, I think uttering kind words is a great start, but we can have greater impact if we imbue our mind and heart with metta. So summoning goodwill before we speak, so that we can minimize agitation, remorse, and regret later. So to me, speaking kind words, it could be maybe you still have a little bit of ill will in your mind, but you're going to speak kind words. Oh, that's very nice of you. Like, okay, or something, right? Whereas, so it's a subset. But when you're imbuing your mind with goodwill, it's bigger. So that's a higher bar, which I like to share with you, to present to you. Can you imbue your heart and mind with goodwill before you speak? Not just say kind words, but really imbue your heart for the goodwill of that person, for the goodwill of yourself, for the goodwill of the society, the community, the group. Okay. And the last one is it the right time? Is it the right time? Timeliness is so important. So say, even if everything else is met, all the other criteria, but it's not the right time, we still have to wait. So for example, if you need to have a relationship conversation with a friend, and what you're going to intend to say is both true, it is factual, it is likely to increase your harmony, it is gentle, you're going to say it very gently, it's going to be beneficial, and it's going to be spoken with a mind of goodwill, but your friend is ill. And of course, it's not the right time to burden them, even though you really, really want to get it off your chest now. Not a good time. Wait for the right time. Wait for the right time. So one other thing I want to add here is about silence. So sometimes it is wisest to stay silent, especially in lieu of idle chatter, which is rushing to fill the space. But notice that lies of omission can be committed through failing to speak, through silence. Adrienne Rich, the poet, says, lying is done with words and also with silence. So clearly silence is not always wise speech, especially in the face of injustice, especially in the face of injustice, when we notice something is wrong, something is inappropriate, we don't speak. We don't speak. We don't speak. It just gets worse and gets worse and gets worse. So silence is not always, sometimes it is a wise response. Sometimes it isn't, just being wise about it. And so to say that, again, it seems like, yeah, situations seem, you know, these guidelines seem pretty straightforward. And yeah, I tend not to lie. And yeah, it's pretty easy, straightforward. But then there's some situations like, oh, yes. Oh, this is that situation. Like, oh, yeah, it's becoming challenging. So it's, again, as I laid out at the beginning, both the making a commitment to these guidelines, but also in real time, what is happening, to practice mindfully, what is happening in the body, what is happening in the mind. There's more I have to say, but I'm going to stop. And we have like 2 minutes for maybe a question. So I had a lot of material to share with you. Thank you for your kind attention. So yeah, we have maybe time for a question.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate. Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.